know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk!
What's up, posers? Welcome to Funk Lotto Pod. I am your co-host, Justin Hensley.
I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And this is the show where we assign our guests a year, and they choose one punk, hardcore, emo, or punk-adjacent record from that year for us to talk about. Today, we have Matt and Griffin of the band Closer on the show with us. They recently just put out their new album, Within One Stem, on Lauren Records and Middleman, and it's really, really wonderful record. Came out this year. Our buddy Steve Doesn't called it one of his favorite records of the year. And what are we talking about today? It's got a very long title by a very long band name.
Gotta get it right. we are talking about the year 2008, and the album is 13 Blues for 13 Moons by the Silver Mount Zion Memorial Orchestra and Tra-La-La Band, otherwise known as A Silver Mount Zion.
This is a really good conversation. We'll get into it more in the show about our prior feelings on the band, or knowledge, or basically anything prior to the band. Didn't know a lot about this band going in, and came out with a very much richer understanding. So it's a really good conversation. I feel like we go very in depth on this album. So
yeah, this is where our show veers into art rock for the foreseeable future. No, absolutely not.
No, next week is not very art rock at all. No. It's a kind of art, but you can go over to our Patreon where we are talking about the albums that came out in 2008 as they appear on the Rate Your Music punk charts.
Good old fashioned chart dive.
Yeah. Getting deep on
a weird year.
It is a weird year. Very, surprisingly, very odd year.
Surprisingly weird year.
Mm-hmm. And Dylan, what about the writing over there? You still writing them words over there?
Well, I mean, I mostly scratch X's. yes. Follow us at punklottopod.substack.com, Substacker 2, and we are recording our intro after the episode.
And before the Patreon.
And before the Patreon, we're all out of order. yes, follow our newsletter at punklottopod.substack.com, and I got to catch up. I'm a little behind.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cheeks, you're a little behind.
Just making a rounds.
And you can find us on all forms of social media at punklottopod. We're pretty much that on every single thing we can think of. Yeah, you know how Google works.
When you come up with a goofy name, it's really easy to have social media synchronicity.
Yeah, we got that SEO on lockdown. Now if people would just start talking about us.
Yeah, throw us a rating on Apple Music. I don't think you can rate podcasts on any other platform.
No, it's obnoxious. And I wish you couldn't rate on iTunes, honestly.
Yeah.
Fuck a rating.
Help us out a lot.
Well, now that I've said the F word on the intro of the episode, let's dive into the show.
Sorry, Mom.
We'll be right back. Are you both on the East Coast?
Yes.
Well, Matt's not only on the coast, he's in Pittsburgh. I'm in New York.
Has gas been an issue at all up there?
No.
Yeah. The price is like a little higher, but there's no one waiting in line for gas up here.
Yeah. I think it's the South is primarily the one that's fucking it all up for everybody.
Yeah, where are you guys?
I'm in North Carolina, so we're the state that has the most empty gas stations right now.
Well, oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh, weird. Yeah, no, I mean, everything seems fine up here, but I don't know.
I'm in Arizona, so okay. There's no...
Yeah, you won't be affected at all by it.
Oh, yeah, so there's no worries over there.
I mean, we just generally have high gas.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was listening to the radio, and it was like, oh, yeah, gas might go up as much as 7 cents a gallon. And I was like, that's why everyone's, like, running to the gas station over 7 cents a gallon? This is crazy.
I feel like gas goes up 7 cents a gallon, like, if I go to the wrong gas station.
Yeah, absolutely.
Easily, yeah.
Yeah, they supposedly fixed, like, I was just reading before here, they supposedly fixed the pipeline issue, so hopefully it'll resume to normal in the next few days, but if everybody goes and fills up every gas can they possibly could find, it'll take a while.
It's a good reason not to go to work, you know?
There's no gas.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I definitely have one of those jobs where they'd be like, well, it still counts against you.
Now I'm looking at this list again.
It's a long list.
I know.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah.
And it's just what's tagged as punk.
Yeah.
Was this record on this list?
Not really.
I don't know but how we found it. I mean, I know like we listened to it, but I don't know how I found it on this list or how we decided to do this record.
I feel like we just thought about what we were doing back then.
Oh, maybe that was why. Yeah,
like,
me and Matt.
Because I was looking up a lot of records, like when were they from? And mostly they were from like 2007 or 2009.
Just
like, trying to think back to like what was going on in my life at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so hard to be like, what was exactly that one year? But like, it came out the year before and you just listened to it a lot in, you know, 2008.
It's a fun exercise, though.
Yeah.
Love It, Nana Grizzle, 2008.
Oh, yeah. I never listened to that record, but yeah.
I guess the first thing we'll do is I'll let you two introduce yourselves so that the audience can tell your voices apart. So please say your name and your role in Closer. Is it Closer or Closer?
The age-old question.
We say Closer. But the ambiguity is deliberate, so either one's fine. Well, I'll start off then. I'm Griffin. I play bass in Closer, and I sometimes scream a little bit, but not too much.
And my name is Matthew, and I play the guitar in Closer, and I never scream. Not one time.
Not once. Ever.
So you just recently put out Within One Stem. And it is quite possibly one of the best Screamo albums of 2021, if you want to call it Screamo. Do you call it Screamo?
Sure.
Well, yeah, we've been calling our band more of an emo band for a while, but we definitely like started it as a Screamo band. So
yeah,
I call it whatever you want to call it.
You just call it rock music.
Rock and roll. Yeah, usually I'm playing a rock and roll band.
Yeah, Matt's always trying to talk up that he's trying to write the perfect pop song through Closer. So definitely the vibe.
How's the reaction to the new record been?
It's been cool. I mean, there's definitely been a lot of like positive feedback on the internet, which I feel like without like playing shows, it's like hard to like really know. So I'm hoping that we get to do that soon. But definitely like what we've seen and heard from people online is really positive.
Yeah. Everything's been positive that I've seen. It was our first time getting a print feature in a UK magazine.
Yeah.
What was that magazine, Matt?
Upset Mag.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. That was very cool.
So we had like a record review in the back and there was like a feature about us in the middle of the magazine with like photos and stuff, which seems like people care more now than they did for the first record. So that's nice.
That's really awesome. I wonder if there's a little bit of nostalgia around like physical media. And I wonder if in the next couple of years, we're going to see a little bit more come back in the way of like print media. I don't know. It
could be
totally off, but
I hope so. I mean, I still read a magazine every morning and I like never read anything. So it's definitely like, maybe I'm a small minority, but it's definitely like easier or like more natural to seek something out.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What now? Like, I know what the current magazine.
What are you guys? What are your love languages? We're just gonna.
What?
Have you guys learned things about each other on the show?
What?
Oh, I see. He's saying because you didn't know about the magazine.
Oh,
thing,
I see.
We're gonna develop.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's not a good joke if you have to explain it.
I was like, "What is my love language?"
Yeah, I also not totally sure.
That's actually a hard question.
Hard hitting questions in the podcast.
I was going to ask which magazines you like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The magazine that I've been reading mostly is Jacobin.
Oh, okay.
Political magazine.
You get that in print? It's online too, you know.
I'm not going to read that online. Absolutely, I get it in print. Come on.
All right. Fair enough.
I mean, there is something about, like, I don't know. I see, like, a written interview on, like, a website somewhere, and I'm less likely to read it on the website than if I, like, have a physical, you know, magazine in front of me. So, you know, print is pretty good for some things, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love print. Don't get me wrong. I just feel like I don't think I've ever seen a Jacobin magazine in the physical form, but I've definitely seen it online. That's all.
Got to spend some more time at my house.
So far away, man.
There.
So the record is like a split release between like a million labels. So here in the U.S. is Lauren Records and Middleman. But then you've got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in Europe?
That is correct.
So like, how did that happen? Like, how did you get in touch with like so many different labels and willing to put it out? I mean, not willing to put it out makes it sound like they're doing you a favor, but
I mean,
like,
that's how we feel. That's how we feel.
They are doing us a favor, honestly. Yeah. Matt, you are involved in that, so why don't you take that one?
Mostly it was Rob, who does Zilpzap Records. They're based in Germany.
In Leipzig.
I was looking for another collaborators to like take it on with him, because the European pressing is like just completely separate from the U.S. pressing, so he wasn't just like buying a certain number of records off of the American release. He was pressing his own, so he was looking for help just taking on like the run. And I think he just reached out to like a bunch of people he'd worked with before, and they all said yes. And so the merrier, and the more countries it's in, the merrier. But it's been cool. It's been really exciting to have it available in Europe. We've had a lot of people like trying to buy records, and it's just like shipping them so much money.
And the first record never had a European release. And when we did our European tour, we sold out of like, we didn't bring that many also because it's expensive to bring them. And so we sold out of all of them by like the third show. And so people were still wanting the first record. And so we were like, this time around, we were very grateful that they will just be in Europe and we don't have to, don't have to worry about trying to send records there, bring a bunch over with us whenever we end up going back. So
yeah, and hopefully it means that going back is much easier next time. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did Lauren Records and Middleman wind up getting involved? Because they're not two labels that I think of having a lot of similarities in their discography.
A great question. The answer to which is that we all used to play in another band that had been on Lauren Records. So Aaron, who runs Lauren Records, was a friend of ours. And when we started Closer, I remember kind of texting him in Kansas City specifically. We were doing our first tour. We had just made this record and we had made a tour tape of it, the record being All This Will Be. And we were kind of like looking for labels to put it out. And Aaron was kind of helping us shop it around and stuff. And then he just texted me. He was like, what if Lauren Records did it? And I was like, is that weird? He's like, no, I think it would be cool. And then Sean from Middleman, I guess, was probably already a friend by that time.
No, I don't think so. Sean was someone who I think I or Ryan, who's the drummer and singer, contacted. And we asked them if they would be interested in putting it out, because they do like all, you know, a ton of the North American screamo stuff, like a lot of it. So we were like, oh, this is like our best. We thought it was just our best bet as far as finding like a label who is pretty DIY and cool and put out cool stuff. They would be interested in putting it out. And lo and behold, Sean was like, I love this. I'm in. And that's, you know, and then I think it only helped that someone else wanted to split the cost, because Sean's very DIY and probably loses quite a lot of money pressing records like this.
So they had already teamed up for the first record, and so we.
Yeah, and Sean was very excited to do the new record. So.
Yeah, Middleman has done a ton of stuff in the last like 2-3 years that like I personally was like, this is so fucking good. Like every time I look at like a new Screamo record, it's like either it's either Middleman or Sagima Beach or The Ghost Is Clear, and like those three labels like do majority of the Screamo records, at least in the United States.
Yeah,
definitely a pretty like small, tight knit circle.
What was your band that you were in on Lauren Records?
It was called Real Life Buildings.
It was like an indie band. It was kind of more of a Matt's brainchild and song. He wrote all the songs. There was a little bit of creative collaboration with the live full band performance, but it was kind of like a, you know, a touring band. Yeah, it was Matt's songs, and we kind of got together to play as a touring band. And we did a number of long U.S. tours with that band that were really fun. I think like 2 full U.S. tours and a couple of shorter ones. Yeah, it was great.
I definitely recognize that name because I followed Lauren Records for a few years now. So, yeah, I definitely am familiar with the name. How did Closer start then?
Well, here's the apocryphal story.
Apocryphal. What about the real story?
This is the real story, I think. Here's the thing I don't remember is were me and Ryan already playing together in Real Life Building?
No. No. The answer is no.
Okay, that's what I thought. So here's the real story. So Griffin and I went to high school together.
And elementary school.
And middle school.
And we were also in, here's the deep story. We were in our first band together when we were 12 that was a ska band.
Hell yeah.
This is correct. Griffin and I have been playing music together more or less consistently, minus a couple years in college, since...
We were 12.
Which was 2002. Wild. And then Ryan and I went to school to college together, so we were both in school at the same time, and we were friendly. We weren't like super close, but we knew each other and we were friendly, and we knew that we were kind of interested in the same music, and we were both in the fine art program. Ryan was in the master's program, and I was in the undergrad program, and we kind of stayed in contact after school, and we're doing some art projects together now and then, and we had just kind of always talked about the idea of playing in a heavy band together, and then but never like really acted on it. But then one day we ran into each other in our practice space. We both were practicing in the same space, Real Life Buildings practice, and Ryan was practicing in their other band at the time, and we both had like an hour to kill, and we were like, oh, let's just fucking just do the band right now. And in that moment we wrote This Year right away, just happened as is, no changes. And then we were like, I was like, Griffin is definitely the missing link. We got to get Griffin. And then the rest is.
Yeah. And then we had a couple practices, and then someone wanted to get us on a show. I don't remember what show it was, at Silent Barn. And it was the thing where I was just like, well, if we're going to be a band, we have to be a band. So let's record a demo. Let's record a demo and make a t-shirt before the first show. And Matt and Ryan were like, really? And I was like, yeah, what are you scared of? Let's just do it. And so we did it. So we had like a really like funny like burnt CDR in like a jewel case, and like a we initially set out to be a very cryptic band, and so our first piece of merch was a crew neck sweater, but the show was in like May or something. Is that true? Yeah, it was the crew neck. The gray crew neck was the first piece of merch we made. Oh, and patches too. We made patches. Yeah, we had the crew neck at the first show.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. At least initially, I think that when I got in the mix, I was like, let's fucking do it. And then they were like, this seems like a lot. And I was like, let's just go for it. And then.
Okay, wait. Can I share my favorite piece of Closer trivia, minutia, rather?
Ever? Yeah, go for it.
For this first show that we were very excited about and decking ourselves out in obscure merchandise, we made a patch that was a skull that just said Closer, but we made it in 2 colorways. And you know how in the subculture of punk rock, there's a lot of like white on black imagery. And oftentimes, if not always, the more DIY of the punks will like just take an image, and in printing it white on black, the image will become negative. So the 2 color schemes of the patches, both were white on black, but one was negative and one was positive.
Matt really loves that.
So It's black on white. Is that what you did?
No. They're both printed white on black, but in one the skull like looks correct.
Oh, and gotcha.
One the skull looks like it's inverted.
That was my idea.
Closer the same both ways though?
Closer was the same both ways. The skull was different. It was very, very subtle.
Love it. I like that it's so subtle that someone would be like, is it a mistake? What?
Yeah. In describing it, it's also so subtle that it kind of doesn't make sense.
So, the first batch came out wrong and you had to redo them. It's kind of what it seems.
Exactly.
So you're Griffin, you're in New York, and Matt, you're in Pittsburgh, right? Or Philly?
Yeah,
you're Pittsburgh. Okay.
And Ryan's in Philly.
So I guess the next question is like, has it always been a long distance band, or is it you just like moved after like you started the band?
Yeah. Let me put it to you this way. When we first started, basically, Ryan was my roommate in Brooklyn. Matt also lived in Brooklyn, and our practice space was a 10-minute walk from my house. And so it was a very close band, and we practiced like once, if not twice a week, every week. And it was very easy. And I'd say, what is it now? Because Matt and Ryan both kind of moved out of the city around the same time. What was that, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
3 years ago.
3 years ago. And so since then, it's been a long distance band, and it's been a little not so easy to get together.
I saw the record was recorded in Philly. Was that just chosen because it was the middle ground?
The record was recorded in Pittsburgh, actually.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
So you chose the furthest for one of you.
Yeah. I mean, Pittsburgh was chosen. A friend of ours who used to play in Real Life Buildings and who went to college with Matt, May, they are a recording engineer. And so they were going to record us. But Matt found a really like high-end recording studio in Pittsburgh. But since it's Pittsburgh, it's very inexpensive to rent. And so we just paid for the studio time, but didn't have to pay for an engineer, because our friend was going to engineer it. And so it was kind of like we wanted to have like a nicer equipment this time around, kind of, you know, it's like a more of a high end like studio with proper ISO booths and everything. And so that was the idea with that.
And I guess the last little bit, last little question I'll ask is, since we're at a point in the pandemic where I guess it looks like the people who are going to get it have gotten the vaccine. So like, some shows have been happening. I know like the New York hardcore thing and the the LA one was very controversial, to say the least. But then also at the same time, the same people who are calling like those shows out for like, oh, you shouldn't be doing this, are also probably planning on going to a festival in like the fall or going to see a touring band like the late summer.
Yeah.
So it's very obviously like this bridge point where like some people are still going to be like, it's too soon. Other people are going to be like, no, let's go now. Does Closer have any plans currently, or is it still wait and see for you?
We have plans to make plans. I think it's still a little bit of wait and see, but I mean, it's very clear that like shows will happen. And I think that if it's like a bad idea, that will become obvious like sooner than later. And if it's not, then it's really just about like, if you're comfortable going, you're going to go, and if keep waiting it out. But I'm feeling like I'm getting there. I'm not like, I wouldn't go to a show today, but I by like August, maybe September. So I think that at least like we've talked about it a little bit, and we've talked loosely about trying to like get something going for the fall, but we haven't like made any concrete steps.
That makes the most sense.
Yeah. But, and then again, like, every single band in the entire world that's ever, you know, wanted to be a band will be trying to play shows all at the same time.
Yeah.
So part of me is like, well, I guess everything's just going to be booked solid for 6 months unless we act right now. So maybe we got to do it, but I'm sure it'll be okay.
Yeah. I think there haven't really been that I've seen really many DIY shows in New York, just like that one, the one New York hardcore show in Tompkins, which was, it kind of became a meme in live time. You know what I mean? It was a little ridiculous in that regard. But it didn't help that a lot of the people who are like the older New York hardcore guys are just COVID truthers. So, you know, it's not exactly like the good look. If you're like, no, it's like we're just having a show outside, it's cool. And being like, John Joseph being like, oh, COVID's a hoax. Or not a hoax. Him being like, if your immune system is strong, COVID can't really hurt you. That kind of thing.
Amen.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so far, at least he's been proven correct in his own right. And he's been kind of an old dude, you know? He's like in his 60s or something, so I don't know. But, you know.
Yeah, I guess it was just, like, who it was is probably the bigger issue. And then, like, what Springa from SSD with his stupid Black Flag Matters? Is that what that jumpsuit said?
Yeah, you know, I had... The thing is before I played in Closer, before I played in Real Life Buildings, I was in kind of like a... Like a very like socially conscious, but kind of like a chuggy, like a chug core vegan straight edge band. And so I like Madball. I like the Cro-Mags didn't play, but I like the Cro-Mags and like I like New York hardcore stuff. And I was like, oh man, like this would be a really fun show to go to. And I was just like, Murphy's Law is not good, but I was like, man, it's definitely going to be a total shit show, like guaranteed shit show. And I was like, you know what? I don't need like a guaranteed shit show. I'll just sit it out, and maybe if I'm proven wrong, maybe the next one I'll go to. And then I didn't go, and sure enough, fucking shit show. So I feel vindicated in that regard, at least.
It could have been, like, well-intentioned, you know, thing that got out of control, but it was treated very much like this is a protest, we're going to do this no matter what you say, and I feel like that kind of guaranteed that it was going to be bad. same with like the that LA show was that looks the fireworks and torches. People came to that with the intention of
starting something.
Yeah, having a free for all.
Yeah, that's for sure. But yeah, but we're excited to play again when we can, you know, when it feels good for everybody.
Yeah,
definitely. But you know, the people who we know who book shows around are not booking shows right now, so that's the other thing too. I feel like once they start doing it again, it'll be like the bellwether that it is time.
Yeah, yeah, and ultimately, like the people who book the shows, I feel like will have the best sense of if people are comfortable coming to shows. So definitely, we'll defer to them also.
Yeah, I also imagine, too, like, the first handful of just, like, regular shows are still going to be a little more wild than you're, like, used to. Because everybody's just been, like, pent up for a year and a half, you know, by that point. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Hopefully everybody can stay healthy and safe, and it'll just turn into, like, a cool thing that gets to come back. Well, cool. Hopefully we'll see you live at some point. We'll see. And let's get into the regular format of the show. So, the basic premise of our show is we assign our guests a year, and they choose one punk, hardcore, emo, screamo, post-hardcore, anything under the punk umbrella record from that year for us to talk about, which kind of didn't do today, but kind of did. We could talk about that later. We gave you the year 2008. And late, and what are some other albums that came out that year that you almost picked before we get into the main record?
Well, let me just say that me and Matt have some very specific overlaps and like great musical affinities, but otherwise we do not in general. So I think the issue was it was hard for us to find a record from 2008 that we were both like really excited about. I would say just for me, I'll give two from 2008 that I love that Matt does not care for. I'm almost positive. The first one being Dystopia's self-titled record, which was a huge touchstone for me. Have you even heard it, Matt?
Never heard it.
Dystopia?
Never heard it.
Okay. Dystopia's self-titled record. amazing, love it. One of my favorite crust bands, punk bands ever. And that final record they did, which was kind of a release of material from, I think, the early 2000s, late 90s. Amazing. Great aesthetics. One of the most consistently aesthetic, bleakest bands ever, in my opinion. And I listen to that record all the time still. The other one being, I'm a big grindcore fan too. So the PLF record, Crushing Fury of Bastardization, also a big touchstone for me as far as kind of like that Houston grindcore sound, Insect Warfare, PLF, all that kind of stuff. So those two are like my big ones from that year. But Matt's not really into the more kind of heavy, metallic, crusty grindcore stuff. So I don't know. What did you have, Matt?
That's correct. Well, I mean, I was just trying to think back a lot to like, yeah, what I was doing at that time. And I feel like in my musical, like that, so 2008 fell right at the end of high school for both of us.
That's true.
And I was like in high school, like prior to that, I was like into a lot of like post-rock kind of stuff was like my most, a big thing.
Oh yeah, me too. Although I just looked and nope, not really many post-rock records came out that year either.
Yeah, like the record I mentioned at the top, this local band at the time called Moving Mountains had just released a record called Numa that was like, I thought, really good, and they were starting to do big things. So I was listening to that a lot and kind of stuff in that world. But then that was like also kind of the moment where I like was getting into the newer wave of like what was happening in the scene, which I feel like the Algernon Cadwallader, some kind of Cadwallader, was like the big record of that, like this is the new moment in the local music scene. And that I love that record. So that was a big one that I didn't necessarily, well, then yeah, I think that record like represented kind of like a big shift in like my relationship with the local. What else stood out? The La Dispute record.
Oh yeah,
like loved that right when it came out, and that was a big thing that got me into the more screamo-y world, which I wasn't really that interested in, except for other than a couple things, notably Circle Takes the Square, courtesy of Griffin. He got me into that. And the other one that stands out to me is Circus Survives on Letting Go, I think was 2008 when I was looking stuff up, which is a record that I still regularly listen to, I have to admit. I'm not necessarily proud of that. But I think that's a great record. I think that and the one before it are incredibly good records. I've never listened to anything.
Juturna? Is that the one before?
Yeah, Juturna, yeah.
Those are the two records that people talk about that band. They've made way more than that, and I don't know if any of them are any good. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, like so.
And Griffin does not care about those records.
I don't care about Sucker Survive. Although me and Matt at the time, in 2008, were in a post-rock band together.
This is correct.
And so we were listening to a lot of post-rock, but the issue is not a lot of post-rock stuff came out in 2008 as I looked through it.
We were behind the times.
Yeah, except for the record we ended up picking, which is like post-rock adjacent, nominally post-rock, honorary post-rock.
And
yeah.
I should also say the two records that I instantly Googled hoping that they came out in 2008 were AFI's December Underground, which came out in 2006.
Yeah, 2006, yeah.
And Joanna Newsom's East, which was, I forget, 2006
seven
also
or
maybe?
Eight. Seven, I think it's later. Five. But those are two records that me and Matt both like love more than like any of, like beyond the pale of anything. So unfortunately, they did not line up right.
That being said, I don't want to discredit a Silver Mount Zion.
No, not
they
at all.
They have been consistently one of my favorite bands of all time since Griffin Irvine first introduced me to Horses in the Sky, probably around 2005 or 6.
It came out in 2005. I think it was when that I showed it. Yeah.
You know, 2008, I was super into like the post-metal, post-rock kind of stuff. And then you're right. I specifically looked up those two like tags on on Rate Your Music to see what came out, and it's hardly anything that I was even listening to.
Yeah.
So like, very clearly, I was listening to stuff that was a few years old. I was probably listening to a lot of Neurosis and Isis still.
Oh, yeah. Pelican.
A lot of Earth, which there's some similarities to Earth with the Silver Mount Zion record.
There is an Earth record in 2008, the Bees Made Honey in the Lion Skull.
Oh, that's a great record, too. I didn't even know that. Damn.
Eternal Kingdom by Cult of Luna came out in 2008.
Also a great record.
That was a really good one. There's that Russian Circles, one of those Russian Circles
records. Yeah.
I think it's the second one.
these are all great records from 2008.
They're not standout though. Like they're not, because I mean there's like, I mean those are kind of the biggest ones really.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You could, if you're going post metal, it's like Intronaut.
Yeah, a Mouth of the Architect record.
Yeah. Which I definitely listened to at this time period. That Zozobra.
Yeah. It's funny, Dylan, you just did like a big like post metal like article in our Substack recently.
Yeah, I talked about earlier 2000 stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah, I was a big Envy fan. Or I am a big Envy fan also, but they didn't have a record from 2008 either. So.
There's something. It's the
Thursday split, which Ryan in our band loves Thursday, and me and Matt are both like, yeah, Thursday's cool. But like they were never the band for us. Yeah, and so I think also I don't think the Envy side of that split is that great personally.
Speaking of Thursday, wasn't he in that United Nations band?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That record came out in 2008.
Huh.
That was an interesting, very hyped record when it came out. I mean, they got in trouble for the Abbey Road On Fire album cover. They had to change it. They got cease and desisted. But yeah, that was like that big, huge super group. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I know about that. I was kind of curious. Who else was in that band?
Because it was Jeff Rickley. It was Daryl Palumbo from
Last Jaw,
yeah. And a bunch of other stuff. I want to say there was like number 12 Looks Like You members.
Ben Kohler?
Yeah, Ben Kohler.
Was it good? Was it a good record?
I liked it then. I have not listened to it since probably 2010. So
it was okay. I saw them play a couple times off of it. It was like, it was a very different vibe than like Thursday or anything like that, you know?
It felt like the idea was probably more cool because they definitely were doing like all those like rip, like album cover rips at that point. And it kind of felt a little dangerous. Like, I think we all knew the story about the Abbey Road thing before the record even came out. So it was like very built up in everyone's mind. And then personally, I felt like it under-delivered the expectation, but I may have just had my expectations too high. I could probably listen to it now and be like, oh, that's pretty good. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Also, I'd like to shout out The Weaker Than. I think that reunion tour also was 2008.
We would have picked it if it were. We also mutually love The Weaker Thans a lot.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the ones that I looked up and was disappointed. It was not in 2008 in that case.
Yeah, but that was 2007.
Yeah. Yep.
Very close.
The last one. Right? Yeah, because then there's like a live record a couple years later.
Yeah, and then there's all the John K. Samson solo stuff, which is also great. Also not in 2008, though.
Yeah.
Love The Weaker Than.
Yeah, absolutely. Dylan, if you were the guest, what would you have picked from 2008? Interesting year.
It's kind of hard to pick one record, and I would think initially going into this year, into this episode, I thought like, oh, that would be impossible because like I was 18 and there's like so much stuff that I remember from that time period. But like looking at the charts, it's actually a lot harder because there's not that much.
It's a weird year. Like it feels like it's like between like two massive years, and like 8 has like some really, really killer records like that mean a lot to me. But like the quantity of records that mean a lot to me isn't necessarily that high.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff that I could talk about from like a purely nostalgic perspective, like that Genghis Tron record, because that's that time period. There's that Torch record, which is on this chart because for some reason it is tagged in the secondary genres as pop punk. I don't know why. But this, looking at the charts, I was just thinking this is a huge identity crisis year for punk.
Yeah.
And I definitely think of this time period as a 2007, 2008, especially as a sort of realignment of punk, especially in hardcore, away from the metalcore stuff and away from kind of the Hot Topic version of emo, the scene. But this is definitely a big year for Ridge 9 Records.
Yeah, Half Heart and Verse.
and verse and
I have a verse record on my list of 2008. Love verse.
And I always think of this too as the era of really when the Death Wish like supremacy kind of starts, more so in 2007. That's where I feel like a lot of the hype is starting to be built up. But there's a really good Blacklisted record, Heavier Than Heaven.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 2008.
There's a Trap Them record, too. That was a big deal. Cursed put out their third album. That would be my pick, I think. Cursed 3.
Mm.
The last one.
I was never that into Cursed. I liked Left 4 Dead a lot, but Cursed didn't do it for me in the same way.
Do you like Ruination?
Ruination never really stuck with me, honestly.
Yeah. It's like the middle ground between like Left 4 Dead. Well, more I guess middle ground of Swarm and Cursed.
Swarm I liked.
Yeah. Yeah, Swarmed were like the punkier side.
But that's also Chris, whatever his name is, right?
Yeah, they're all Chris Callahan.
Yeah. Oh, they're all Chris Callahan. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought.
Now, another thing that I just remembered, Dylan, what you were saying squares a lot with my experience at the time, even though it's kind of a different scenes, more of like the like indie post-rock transitioning to like what became like an indie punk scene or whatever was you want to call that. And one band that kind of was a, like quintessential of that transition. Well, no, because they have nothing to do with post-rock, but Griffin, Bridge and Tunnel. Do you remember mm-hmm. their?
Oh, yeah, Bridge and Tunnel. Yeah, of course.
They were like, I love that band. And that record came out in 2008, whatever, I forget what it's called.
East-West?
East-West.
Dylan, did we do that record? Or did we do another one? We did a Bridge and Tunnel record real early in our run, like when we had no guests. It was just the two of us. We did that in like a Native EP, the same episode.
We talked about East-West.
Yeah.
Yeah, that record coming out, they were like big, I think big in my like, transition of like what I was getting into, and they kind of were harbingers of like a new sound, the sort of more mathy Algernon-y indie rock that still had a lot of
there's been a lot of talk on Twitter about emo in the last couple months, which much to Dylan's chagrin he's just tired of talking about it. What is like the waves of emo?
Well, there was that one that was like that that Midwest emo meme, right? It went around for a while.
Yeah, and then there's like that iceberg meme, and then there's been a bunch of like that, that fifth wave emo thing that went around where everybody was like, these are not new genres, this is all the same genre. You're just
what you gotta look out for is the fourth wave of ska is definitely coming fast.
Yeah, it's new tone.
Is that what they're calling it?
New tone.
Wow, I didn't know there was a name for it. That's exciting.
I feel like that's a paper line from French paper company.
This is like in you with the umlaut over it. This is like nu metal.
Yeah,
2008 is a very like transitionary year for a lot of different sounds for sure. Let's go ahead and talk about the record you actually picked. So we gave you 2008 and you picked the Silver Mountain Zion Memorial Orchestra and Tralala Band's 13 Blues for 13 Moons.
Heard this record before?
No,
absolutely not.
Had you heard of the Silver Mount Zion before?
Yes. Okay. I have. I've heard other albums before.
Yeah.
That's I hadn't fair. Heard this one specifically.
You know, when we picked it, I feel like we picked it because what we really wanted was like Horses in the Sky or something, which is a different record of theirs. But I will say that in revisiting all of their work, this though it was a record, it's not their best record, I don't think, but it's a great record.
I think this is a very good record. I definitely love this record.
Well, I've got some stats on the record I'll run through real quick before we get into the full opinion section.
That's my full opinion.
They are from Montreal, Quebec, formed in 1999. This was released March 10th, 2008 on Constellation Records, as are all of their records. This is their fifth full-length album, which is followed up their 2005 album, Horses in the Sky. The personnel on this record is Thierry Amar on contrabass and electric bass, Eric Craven on drums, Becky Foon on cello, Ian Ilavsky on guitar and organ, Ephraim Manouk on guitar and main vocals, Jessica Moss on violin, Sophie Trudeau on violin, and almost everyone else contributes vocals, with Ephraim taking the lead most of the time. There's some additional horns by Brian Lipson and organ by Nadia Moss. And the album was produced by Howard Billerman and Radwan Mumne. Maybe. I hope that's right. But so, yeah. Very first question I always ask is, what made you choose this album specifically?
Well, I think Griffin said earlier that we have mostly divergent music tastes. So we were definitely looking for something that we both agreed on. And as soon as this was like suggested, we were just like, yeah, that's it. That's the one. So maybe it was more instinctual than for a specific reason.
Yeah, I would say it was the kind of thing where we ran a couple of records across. Oh, I like it. Matt's like, I don't. He's like, I like this. I'm like, I don't care. And when we hit on this one, it was just like immediately like, oh yeah, that's it. That's the one. It just felt right. Because I feel like we've also, there's always been moments on, because we've toured a lot with each other in various bands. We went on our first tour together with another different band that Matt had in college, and I did merch for them, first cross-country tour. And I feel like there are these moments that were these very formative moments of like driving through the middle of the night, and someone would just like put on Silver Mount Zion. Usually Horses in the Sky, but occasionally 13 Blues for 13 Moons. I remember one time in particular, because they do a lot of vocal rounds, which I think is a very like underutilized feature in modern music, because it makes for some cool moments. I remember the person we were playing a show with had snuck us into the sewers underneath Austin, Texas, at like 1 a.m. And our good friend Zoe Grant, shout out to Zoe Grant, who also was with us there, started singing the round from, I believe, God Bless Our Dead Marines, where it's like, when the world is sick, can't no one be well. But I dreamt we were all beautiful and strong. And we started singing it as vocal rounds. Down these like 20-foot echoing concrete, you know, tunnels, and it was like amazing, and it was totally random and not planned at all, but it's something that I still think about often as like a very memorable tour moment. And so I think in that regard, we just have a very deep connection between one another related to this band, aside from all the listening to the band we've done on our own, you know. So
yeah,
Dylan, what is your prior? I don't think you didn't know this record before either. So what is your prior Silver Mount Zion, not opinion, but more of just like your general feeling on them?
They've never really been presented to me in a way that made me want to go out of my way to listen to them. And it's very clearly not the kind of music you're just going to accidentally come across. So I really have never had much of an opinion of them, or really much of a conception of them. Just like, I know the name, I know they're associated with post-rock, otherwise experimental music. But yeah, other than that, it's just going into this record was kind of a blank slate. Like, I had no idea if this was going to be like Twinkle Twinkle post-rock, or like really out there, or... I mean, I kind of figured that they would have some kind of orchestral elements, classical elements and influences. So that was probably the only real preconception I had.
So I have always been confused by this band, not in the sense of like
That's fair, honestly.
Not like why people like, not that kind of confusion, but more of like,
don't worry.
I thought they were other bands. So like, I got basically all the Godspeed, You Black Emperor records and Silver Mountain Zion records just shuffled up in my head because they feature like half the same member. Well, half the members of this band are in Explosions in or not. Not Explosions in the Sky. That's another band.
There you go.
Godspeed. So like, I never knew, plus the fact that like their name is different on almost every single record they have always threw me off. I was like, that seems like too much work for me to try and figure out what's going on with this band. So I have listened to one or two of their records prior to this one. Definitely the one with like the red and black cover, the crow on it, I think. And pull it up, see if I can get the title of that record.
Is that He Has Left Us?
They have some pretty crazy titles, too.
Born Into the Trouble, oh, yeah, as the Sparks Fly Upward.
That was their first record, I think.
And then I have listened to He Has Left Us Alone, but Shafts of Light, something. It cuts off the rest of the title. But
yeah. And those records are very different from this, which I think is kind of like the beginning of their later sound. Very different band.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, because when you sent me when I sent you the list of records to look at, or like, and then you sent this one back to me as your pick, my initial response was, "Oh, that's not really punk, but whatever."
Strong disagree.
I also would say strong disagree. I mean, that's a whole different topic though. Of conversation is about like talking about. Okay, well let's tie it in real quick.
Is this a punk record?
So we're talking about before 2008 is this time of transition in a lot of genres, a lot of moments, this kind of weird in-between moment. And I think that it's great in that regard, because though I think two records before this one was their record, This Is Our Punk Rock, literally is what it's called, The Rusted Satellites Gather and Sing, the subtitle. But I think this record is a very interesting idea of just kind of like reconceptualizing what is, I mean, they've been doing it in other records too, but like, what is punk music? Like, what is kind of counterculture music? What is like an avant-garde aesthetic as like a political statement mean? And I think that it's a little more interesting, a little more poetic, and a little better than a lot of more traditional punk rock was at this particular juncture. I mean, the verse record from this year is pretty good as far as political hardcore goes, but you know, I always liked and do like Silver Mount Zion for like their poeticism, for their lyrics, for their just like this how they sound. And it's a very different departure from Godspeed, say, which all the vocals are from samples or from interviews and they aren't sung. So I don't know, at least for me it's like kind of a moment of like transition between like what I think things can be and do in that regard. Because beforehand, when we were really into post rock and stuff, we played in kind of a punky post rock band, but I feel like there was more of a division between those two genres, like post-rock and punk, and like those kind of efficacies were not totally melded. And so I think this record does a good job of melding those two otherwise disparate elements.
And I'll just say that I think that their record, This Is Our Punk Rock, says it all. Like, I think punk rock is open to interpretation, and it's just as much about ethos as it is about the actual sound. It's about the reasons why you're doing it. And I think that Silver Mount Zion is firmly a punk band in that they've always been steadfast in their like ideology, in their political ideology as a band. They've always been a very political band, and they've always been a very intentional band that like makes all their artistic choices based on an ethos, which I would say is a punk ethos. And I think that probably contributes in a lot of ways to like what Dylan was saying. Like, they're kind of hard to find on your own because they're kind of intentionally obscure and a bit idiosyncratic. But I would say that the intentions of the band are definitely in line with what I think being punk rock.
So
I'll say I think it counts because listening to it, I thought a lot of about like No Wave and a lot of early 80s industrial, which so much of that comes out of punk directly, both in the UK and in the US. And I mean, you can listen to like Pure Ubu records and hear some of that in this, and you can listen to, and I think in a lot of ways, post-rock as a genre overall, if we're classifying this as post-rock, all kind of comes out of industrial and no wave to begin with, and a lot of early alternative. And I think anytime you're actively subverting conventions of rock music, you're in essence doing what most people considered punk from its inception. So, yeah.
I'll add on to this that my initial reaction of it being like not a punk record comes from not actually listened to this album and like really like reading about them as far as like their approach to not only, you know, lyrics, but also like their packaging. And, you know, there's very much a DIY aesthetic to this group. So before this episode, or before listening to this record, I would have said not a punk band, but listening to the album and reading about them, I am firmly on the, yeah, this is punk. It's not like, it's not skate punk, it's not pop punk, it's like, it's punk in philosophy, more than
punk rock, if you will.
You two are obviously fans of the record prior to this one, so I want to get Dylan's take on, did you actually like listening to the record?
I want to say, like, I want to say that I got it creatively, philosophically, politically, found parts of it that were really inspiring and really cool to listen to, and then other parts that I'm like, eh. And the parts that I'm kind of meh on with a band like this aren't just like, you know, 1-2 minute song or like a part of a song. They're like maybe a substantial chunk of a song because they're all pretty long. And there's a lot of repetition and there's a lot of building. And sometimes that really, really works. And then other times it doesn't for me on this record. So overall, I'm just kind of really in the middle on it.
I really enjoyed it. So this, they do a couple things that I that test the limits of my patience. I've said before a lot on the show that like I think I burned out my bandwidth for really, really long songs in my like early 20s because I listened to so much post metal and post rock, like all these, like I probably listened to too many drone records where it's just like the same thing for 30 minutes straight, or like a sleep record that's like one song for an entire record.
Oh yeah.
So there was a point where I was just like, oh man, 13-minute song, 16-minute song. I'm not going to like this at all. And then found myself just being pleasantly surprised by how much I thoroughly enjoyed this record.
I will say I have a lot of the same reservations as Justin, and I have previously, but in the last few years especially, I've talked too much about it, but this is the only time on this show where it's appropriate, but I've listened to a lot of jazz. And
now we're talking.
I have found myself coming back to enjoying instrumental music, and there's a lot of instrumental parts to this record that really are my favorite parts of it. And found myself in the perfect point of like coming from a post-metal, post-rock background a lot in my teens into my 30s now, exploring other genres of music. I feel like listening to this record now is the right time for me to listen to this record. In my 20s, mid-20s, early 20s, absolutely would not have liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also have gotten really into jazz in the past couple of years too, so I feel you on that. And also, that was my return to instrumental music. I hadn't really been, I mean, there's lyrics in this, so I feel like this is kind of more lyric-y music, though it is orchestral. But I hadn't listened to any like instrumental music in years and years and years until I started listening to jazz. So
yeah, there's definitely, so the record, it starts off with 12 tracks.
Oh yeah.
Like less than 10 seconds on feedback, drone, whatever you want to call it. And my initial reaction was like, why did they do that? Like, you could have just had that, you know, like in front of the first song, and then like it would have been fine. Maybe they were trying to get their Last FM stats up for a record, but joke's on them, because if the song's less than, 15 seconds, it doesn't count on Last FM or something like that.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I feel like I can say, based on their political and artistic stances, that was firmly not their intention.
I was wondering how many tracks is it? Again?
It's 16 in total.
16, yeah.
Which is, yeah, I always thought, I was like, as I remembered it, was that it was 13 tracks, like the 13 theme. But then when I looked at it, I was like, wait a second, why did they have that many tracks of silence then? Or like noise, rather, if it wasn't even like the right number. But it must be some kind of like, I mean, I don't know, it must be some kind of like esoteric, Kabbalistic thing on the part of Ephraim, I would think. I'm not sure.
But I was wondering specifically while I was listening to it, like, I happened to just look at my phone. And I was like, whoa, what? Why is it going so fast? And I was like, oh. And I was thinking, like, what's the Spotify payout on that? Is there a time limit?
This is a pre-Spotify record. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. But now it's like, oh, hey, yeah. That's a quick,
there's gotta be. There's
quick
gotta
paycheck.
Be. Yeah, I wonder.
So yeah, the album truly starts with 1 million died to make this sound.
And I will add, right now I have the record in front of me, and the track listing starts at 13. Mm-hmm. The first 12 songs are not listed.
Oh, interesting.
They're just there.
It starts at number 13. Oh, okay. Final,
it's just track 13, track 14, track 15, track 16.
That makes sense.
No other tracks.
Huh.
And this is a fairly analog band. Like the packaging is important to them. I think they're thinking of the final piece as the physical piece, not necessarily first and foremost.
Yeah, it's funny because 2008 was still very much like CD was still the dominant form of physical media, but they very much struck me as like the band that does vinyl because they think vinyl's cool.
I think there is a CD version too, though, of this record. I'm almost positive.
Yeah.
But yeah, all their vinyl packaging is like the very just beautiful, very well considered, very unique, very well done.
They have a visual style that's very similar to like late 2000 or late 90s like screamo records, like a lot of like the screen printed on like recycled cardboard and like, or just naked cardboard, nothing like actually on it. Visually very much in line with a lot of DIY screamo from late 90s, early 2000s. So like that adds to the punk ethos there for sure. And I've always thought their artwork's just like really rad looking.
Yeah. I love all of their production and everything like that. And all the Godspeed stuff too is also incredible with all the goodies they throw in, like the train flattened penny, and like the weird scream, like that's glued Polaroid and all kinds of stuff like that. It makes it feel, yeah. I think Matt is onto something insofar as there is something about the physicality of it and like holding it, you know, and experience, you know, just like that, the kind of getting closer to something that's not even the music, but is related to the music.
So there are four like true songs on the album. Million Died to Make the Sound, 13 Blues to 13 Moons, Blackwater's Blowed, Engine Broke Blues, and Blind, Blind, Blind. The songs do a lot as far as there's very a lot of moving parts to it, a lot of like building and breaking back down and then rebuilding. So it's kind of hard to like necessarily be like, what's your favorite song on the album?
Sure.
But it, if you could pick your favorite song, is there one?
Yeah, actually, I was ready for this question. Interestingly, in revisiting it before, I feel like me and Matt had a lot of we got a lot of mileage, at least collectively, out of the last song, Blind, 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 especially that kind of like very quiet part that comes in, the very like policemen in parallel lines, bum, 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 bum. That part, you know, and I really, that was the most memorable part of this record for me, because as I said before, before I was more of like a Horses in the Sky, that was my real favorite. But this time around, listening to it a number of times, getting ready for this interview, my favorite song for sure now is the third song, Blackwater's Blowed, Engine Broke Blues. And I didn't really remember it for, like going into it, because I hadn't listened to the record in a while. And so it was a pleasant surprise. It's interesting, like the building is very, it's very clever. I don't know, I feel like it has so many seeds of future melodies that you don't even notice until you realize, like until you understand the movement of one melody to the other one, you see all these kind of threaded in pieces until it assembles like later on. And so I don't know, I found that one just really great, lyrically very powerful, and that was the one I kept after I listened to the record as a whole a number of times. I just kept listening to that song over and over again. So
it's so funny you said that, because I think it's my least favorite track. Hey.
That one has a riff, well, not even really a riff, just kind of a more like a chord strummed that repeatedly, obviously, for a long time, that has a tone to it that really, really reminds me of Neurosis, Sun That Never Sets, and kind of everything that they did afterward. It's kind of a thing that they did have done repeatedly over the last two decades. but it's a, there's just a certain tone that it's very, very satisfying to me.
Huh, like I'm curious what that tone is.
I'd have to find that part and figure out the, a, the specific.
Yeah. That's the problem with these like really long songs. It's really hard to be like, you know, that track, like the track with seven parts. Like,
yeah. Yeah. The timestamps.
It's just like, it's definitely a distorted guitar, but it's like just distorted. And it's got this really clear bell tone to it. It's just,
you're talking about like the product, like the sound, the production.
Yeah, specifically the sound of the guitar, the
quality
guitar tone.
Of the chord. Got it.
Yeah,
I was thinking this was some secret chord that David played in and pleased the Lord kind of shit.
More of a brown sound.
Yeah. I understand that. Definitely. I mean, I think the production is fantastic. And I believe it's all analog, all recorded straight to tape. It just sounds phenomenal.
Matt, do you have a favorite track, song?
You know, honestly, I hate to be that guy, but I'm very much like an albums guy. And on most albums, like I don't even know what the songs are called, because I'll just put on the album and I listen to it. And I have to say, like, I think this album as a whole is just like really thoughtfully composed. Blind, Blind, Blind is maybe the standout, but does it hold up on its own without the rest of the songs? Like, who can say? I think as an album, it's just really, really solid. I like all of it.
I mean, I'm normally that kind of person too. Like, I'm definitely a whole album person. I'm not like a person who just only wants to hear like a track or two from a record. I guess working on the show for 4 years yet? It kind of has train me to like pick out songs specifically, yeah. I know exactly what you mean. When I'm listening to for enjoyment, that's how I enjoy a record.
Yeah.
When I'm studying it for a podcast, it's a little different, I guess. But
yeah,
but definitely, like if I go to put the record on, like I'll just put the record on. I won't like go for a song. And I think that they're all good. I have parts of all of them that I really respond to.
For sure. Blind 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 has this triumphant feel to it. Very like uplifting almost. Especially compared to like the other three tracks, because those are a little more aggressive, especially Million Died to Make the Sound. Blind 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 was like the most like unique sounding song on the album. But yeah, there's definitely a lot to really enjoy there.
Yeah, and they definitely have a tradition of having like the record closers being these sort of like grand idealistic song. So it fits that pattern, you know, to an extent. Definitely the most like idealistic after a lot of more angry songs.
Dylan, do you have a favorite track or moment on the album?
I think 13 Blues for 13 Moons, the title track, is probably the most consistent for me in terms of what I enjoy. I mean, it has that tone that I talked about. Mm-hmm. It has I'll just call it the Dragonaut riff. it really did. Like, as soon as it came out, I was like, what's that? Is that Sabbath? No, it's Sleep. It's got some pretty like frantic and aggressive parts that are exciting and offer an interesting contrast, I think, to generally when they do that, I really dig it throughout the record.
That track has a really cool like tribally sort of drum feel to it that totally gives me Neurosis vibes. But then there's like sort of this twangy almost like Earth style, like Earth's Hex, you know, sound. That one specifically is one that I feel like it builds up and drops off like the most on the album. Like it has the most, I don't know what they personally view it as, if they like breaking it down, but definitely the most like building back up sections. It's so funny. And my favorite track is The Million Died to Make the Sound. So we've kind of hit all four of the main tracks.
That's great. I love that.
That one's like, to me, that's the most aggressive track on the album, but it also starts very gently.
With
all the voices and like the plucking of the, I guess the violins that they're plucking. And then like, there's lots of strings on here which maybe gave me some like Kashmir by Led Zeppelin vibes even.
Well, Matt loves Led Zeppelin, so that's good.
Is that true? I'm down with Led Zeppelin. Yeah. I wouldn't say I love Led Zeppelin. But, you know, Led Zeppelin's just playing the blues, and this record is very explicitly a blues record.
It's in the name.
Yeah, you know what? What was I expecting? You're right.
I mean, you can be whatever genre of music you decide to call yourself. I mean, just see all of the bands who call themselves power pop.
Yeah.
That's what they are. Shoegaze? Sure. If you say so.
Definitely the title track, 13 Blues, is, you know, it's like one big blues riff over and over. Or it's one big blues riff and then another big blues riff. It's like, you know, very much drawing on blues in it.
That one had some of it reminded me of some like Sacred Heart, like choral singing. I don't know if you're either familiar with that particular style, but yeah, you're right. With the rounds, that's what you were referring to earlier. Like that's definitely heavily in Sacred Heart singing. So yeah, I get a lot of that. I hear, are either of you familiar with a band called the Psalters? They're kind of obscure.
Oh, I saw them play once in Tompkins Square Park. They're kind of like Christian-y, right? They opened for Defiance Ohio once in Tompkins Square Park. I know you're talking about.
Yeah. They're definitely, they're lumped in with the Christian scene, but they're also anarchists, which is really cool.
They're like the Christian theologists, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're wearing all white robes when they played. That's why I think of the Christian.
They contributed to some Me Without You stuff.
Too. Yeah, yeah.
That's their biggest. The Christian connection continues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But their style kind of reminds me of this too. Like, it's very hard specific sound to really tie that band to, because they're also very vocal group centric. But yeah, I thought of that band when I was listening to this album. Even though this album came out later than when their first couple albums were out. But
I think there's definitely a devotional aspect to the band in general. That's pretty spot on, and I like that a lot about them.
Have either of you seen them live?
Several times. Yes.
Yeah.
I was also just going to say, I guess it's like dark where I am now.
But very dark.
I have the record in front of me, and the lyric book is in this little zine. I could turn some lights on.
Turn on the lights.
They're all in this little booklet, and the cover of it is just a scan of a prayer book, and it says "Hymnos de Sion" on the cover. So that's definitely an intentional reference. And I'm fairly certain that Ephraim is Jewish, if not most of the band, and definitely in Judaism, like song is such a big part of tradition. And singing together is a big part of like the religious activities as they take place on a daily basis, which is like a really nice part about Judaism and celebrating those holidays in my experience. So there's definitely like an influence of that is clear if you've like been part of that.
Is it weird that I get a little bit of Damon from Blur's vocals when I hear Ephraim singing?
That's honestly, I know that I've heard Blur, but I can't place what their songs are.
I agree with Matt. That makes sense, I guess, but also I don't know.
Are you more familiar with the Gorillaz records?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That's the same guy?
Yeah, it's the same dude.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, Gorillaz are cool.
Yeah.
I like that. I will say the first time I saw Mount Zion live, I had a realization, which is that he sings with his tongue out. And that's why he sounds the way he sounds. He does that intentionally, almost definitely, to like change his voice.
Yeah.
Definitely here's works.
Here's the lyric.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. And they said this was the first album they released with lyrics, like printed in the record.
That sounds about right. Definitely, like, I know Horse in the Sky had a similar lyric book, but it didn't actually have the words. It just had like other stuff for each song. Yeah.
Writings.
Fantastic. I love that. But you know, the lyrics are good. It's nice to be able to look.
You know, when I was younger, I didn't really care. I don't know. I have a weird like appreciation of lyrics. Like now when I listen to music, I don't really pay attention to what they're singing. But like if I go read the lyrics, I hope it's something I really like, because I don't want to go in there and being like, oh man, this is nothing. Like yeah. Or the exact opposite of what I, you know, personally believe in. So I like that they are very, very political with their approach.
Yeah, definitely. Lyrics have always been fairly important to me. I mean, I like instrumental music, but it's really hard for me to like music with bad lyrics. But if the music's really good and the lyrics are like mediocre, then that's okay. But the lyric, like, you know, the lyrics, like if you're going to say something, it should be worth saying.
I went to look at some like reviews or like what people thought of the record. According to the Punishers that Rate Your Music, this is their second least popular record and the second lowest rated album overall
of within the Mount Zion discography.
Yeah, which I don't know if that just comes from it's kind of departure with like the heavier use of vocals on this record than they've normally done or prior too much, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, because definitely the records following this one like took on this blueprint more than the previous
record. Yeah, the one right after this one, the 2010 record, is like the least popular and lowest rated out of all their albums.
Oh, Collapse Traditional.
Really? That's that's a fucking good record. Can I add that on this? Are we allowed to curse?
Yeah.
I'll say on NPR. An aside for the rateyourmusic.com is our... Despite any coverage our new record got, to bring it back to our record for a second.
Yeah.
There was one person on Rate Your Music who like didn't like the first record, and they liked the new record slightly more. And I was like, we did it. We convinced the trolls on the internet that your record is good. Or at least better.
How do you know it was the same person?
Because it's the same profile name. And they were like, glad I gave this band another chance. This record this record is better. 3 stars.
No, Collapse Traditionals is a fantastic record. It's definitely a harder record to listen to. It's more aggressive, a lot more like obtuse, but it's really good. But, you know, who am I? Yeah.
Most of the reviews from this time period were really positive. Like, almost every review was positive, except the Pitchfork review.
Oh, shit.
That doesn't surprise me.
Wow.
I feel like this band is against everything that Pitchfork is for. So it's like, if they liked the record, they would be discrediting themselves.
So Pitchfork likes every other album way more than this one. So like the rest are like, they start at like 7 and they go to like 9. Like, and they're 10 wow. point scale. So like, they're favorable on towards all the records. This one has a 5.2. Mm-hmm. And I read the review and I was like, whatever, dude. And I got to the very end of the article or the review, and this kind of made me mad more than anything. So I'll just read what they wrote. Overall, it's the sense of forced importance that makes the album no fun. You feel like it's meant to do something to you, not for you. I don't know about you, but I've got more than enough tyrants and oligarchs talking down to me already without being browbeaten by anarchists, too.
Wow, that's a bitter reviewer.
I mean, I feel like it is typical of anarchists to browbeat. I mean, that's kind of like their whole deal, right? So it's weird to go into an anarchist record and say this forced importance is off-putting. Like, I mean, you ever listen to a Crass record? I mean, it just comes with the territory, man.
I also don't feel like this record advertises itself as being like anarchist doctrine music.
Yeah.
It's right. Like, it's definitely like just a punk record. Like, listen to the lyric.
But I think that it's the kind of thing where the record makes the most sense coming to it from an anarchist lens. But I don't think that it like projects out the anarchist like
sure,
ethos. Sure. But if you come to it with that understanding, I think you get more out of it than if you. But I don't think. But that's the thing. I don't think you get that out of it.
Sure.
In and of itself, it doesn't have that.
If your job is in like music taste making. Then a lyric like "No heroes on my radio" is maybe a little bit like hard to jive with.
They specifically had a problem with what is the line about
your band is bland?
Yeah, yeah. They really had a problem with that line.
Doesn't surprise me.
Which I like. I agree with that line. Like, I feel like more bands need to take advantage of whatever platform they have and maybe like actually say something of like some meaning, you know, instead of just, I mean, every type of music has a different purpose, but you know.
And if I may read you the lyrics, your band is bland. Your band's bland ambition. So it's not simply your band is bland.
Yeah.
There's a little more to it than that, though I'm sure that sentiment is, they're happy if you take that away.
I mean, I agree with the your a bland ambition. Like, it's very off-putting whenever I'm like, oh, it's just, I don't know, you don't care about what you're saying. You're just trying to, I don't know, appeal to as many people as possible, but without necessarily making partying your main ethic. I don't know what I'm trying to go with this, but because there's certainly a place for party music, like just feel good fun music. But
oh sure, absolutely,
if that's what you're really feeling.
Yeah,
you can't just party for the paycheck.
No,
it has to come from a place of earnest partying.
It's true.
I mean,
it's true.
You listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you know they mean it. Like,
I've been listening a lot recently, like while I'm making coffee in the morning, to the 90s New Zealand hit song, How Bizarre, by OMC. And it's definitely feel-good pop party music. It's very good. In that regard, it makes me feel better in the mornings. So
that song comes up in my life more than you'd expect. Just like...
You know, it only came up in my life very recently. I was working here at this office with my friend David, who Matt also grew up with, a dear friend of ours from our hometown. And he was like, he's always a funny DJ. And he was like, let's put on some fun music. And I was like, okay. And he put on that song. And I was like, this song is great. Who is this? And he was like, oh, it's OMC. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And I was like, yeah. Anyway, great song.
Yeah, this is definitely not party music.
No.
It's a good way to get kicked out of the party if I put it on.
When that like 12 tracks of drone kicks off, you're like, what is gonna happen?
What's happening to this party now?
It's a kind of party music.
Yeah, like you're making a bunch of Molotov cocktails. You're getting ready. You're getting ready for the demo. Real solemn though. It's not even like a fun. Like it's not gonna be a fun fight. It's gonna be a really sad fight. You're gonna lose.
Damn. I like this record because it reminds me that I was young and idealistic at one time, and that's good. You know that maybe I still can respond to that. That aesthetic.
The last little bit I have here is the members of this band also played in Godspeed, which we mentioned earlier, and some of them contributed to albums by the Arcade Fire, who I think feel like they stole like their whole some Mount Zion's like gimmick, imagery at least. They played on a Jay Massis record, Grant Hart record, British Sea Power, Vic Chestnut. They did two records collaborating with Vic Chestnut, which are really awesome. Land of Talk and the Scott Pilgrim soundtrack.
Huh. I didn't know that they were involved with all those other things. That's very interesting.
The British Sea Power one is even in like the same year. It's like, Do You Like Rock Music is the record. And I think it's the violinists are on that record. So it's more like session work, I guess, but
yeah,
it's still cool that they're involved. And the band is still together and have released two albums since 2008. Ian, Becky, and Eric have also since left the band. So,
and I think down. That, I think Ephraim and one of the violin players have a child together also since 2008.
They are a quintet now, I think is what our last thing I read was. And they have a new drummer because Eric was their drummer.
Hmm.
But that's it. That's all that I have. Anyone have any closing thoughts on the album? Or
I think Matt summed it up pretty well.
Yeah.
I would just, my closing thought is that I've also always thought of this record as a stadium rock record.
And it's a jock jam for sure.
This is what I want all stadium rock to sound like.
All right.
No. Hey! But it's 13 minutes long and very intense.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and choosing this record for us to talk about. I feel like I know way more about this band. Like, I have a grasp on this band now.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. I mean, it was fun to talk about it and to like revisit it in this very intentional way. So
definitely.
Yeah.
Where can everyone find Closer online?
Oh, we're on Bandcamp and everywhere. Actually, I guess we're on all the streaming stuff too, but Bandcamp's the best for us, I guess. So it would be closernyc.bandcamp.com. And then also I think kind of you can find it wherever for streaming.
Yeah. We are active on the internet. We have Instagram. Where the handle is Closer is a Band, and that's possibly also our handle on Twitter, where I've never been. We also have a Facebook that we don't use.
I check it periodically. Not a lot goes on Facebook,
but definitely our music can be found on Bandcamp and is available on a vinyl LP, which I would also like to. It was fairly well considered in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
In the US and in Europe.
And lastly, we feel like punk rock says we need to do something, whether politically, socially, just helping out your community. What are some charities or nonprofits that you personally like that you would like to bring some attention to?
Recently, we did a fundraiser. I don't remember what we sold. Was it a Test Press, Matt?
I think it was just one of the All This Will Be records.
Oh, yeah, one of our old, well, we found a couple more of the first record. We did like a kind of a raffle for that, and we gave all the money to Red Canary Song, which was a group that helps like Asian American Pacific Islander sex workers based out of New York in the wake of the shootings. I believe, what was it, in Virginia, right? Was that Virginia?
It was Georgia.
Georgia, yeah, Atlanta. Excuse me. Yeah. So we did that. But I think me and Matt talked about this a little bit before. Kind of wherever money is needed. Mutual aid is always good. Direct money to people who are in Gaza who are getting their houses destroyed. You know, there's no end of good sources or needy people who need help if you have the money.
I think also in like, you know, local music, it's got to be a lot about responding to your community needs. We did a previous raffle fundraiser, which I liked the concept of, which was that the winner of the raffle got to pick the charity that we donated the money to. which ended up going to a harm reduction organization in New Jersey. So, I mean, you know, there's everyone's situation is so different and everything going on where everyone is so different. And there's so many causes. So
thank you. We'll make sure to include links to the specific charities you mentioned. And yeah, thanks a lot for doing the show. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. It's always fun to talk.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great.